young mother looked into the bedroom one evening, and she saw her junior executive husband standing silently by the baby's crib, looking down thoughtfully. In his face, she could read his wonder and joy. She softly went to him and took his hand in hers. She said, "A penny for your thoughts." He turned and looked at her with awe, with amazement in his eyes. "I just can't believe it," he said. "How on earth can the manufacturer make a crib like that for $49.95? It's a magical season, isn't it? During Advent many years ago, when I was a teenager, a member of our Pilgrim Fellowship Congregational Church youth group asked me if my family had put up the Christmas tree in creche, knowing the Dowd family had a habit of getting things accomplished at the last minute. I told her that our tree was up, but we weren't going to eat our creche until Christmas Day. She informed me with disgust in her voice that a creche had nothing to do with food. The creche is a nativity scene. I didn't know that. I had not been educated properly because I grew up in Wisconsin. She added, "You know, John, you don't know what a creche is. You probably haven't any idea what a nativity scene is either. So I'll explain it to you." Well, here we go. You can look right over here. You know, the manger, Mother Mary, Father Joseph, animals, angels, wise men, shepherds, all around the baby Jesus on the eve of his birth. And then in my wise, cracking sort of way, I asked about why. Why in the world do we celebrate the birth of Jesus on December 25th, since the baby Jesus obviously was born the night before, December 24th? That's right? Silent night, right? Unless it was past midnight, I guess. But have you... Does anyone have an answer?
We hope you do.
No. I'm from Wisconsin. Now you're really mixing things up. You know, some say April, right? Yeah, it was a long ride on those camels. Camelback. Yeah, and they were wise, right? There were shepherds, yeah. The shepherds in the spring. I'm just going down there, and you can come up. You're giving me the sermon. This is wonderful. But this is right. Shepherds, Anna's right. So we're talking about springtime. In fact, getting into the Easter time with the palms, that's actually in the fall, harvest time, when Easter is supposed to be like in the fall, but I'll get to that a little bit later. I'm jumping the gun. I do remember, because we have our Wisconsin contingent here, Nancy might remember Fred Rennebaum, right? Well, he was the Sunday school teacher, Fred, in our First Congregational Church of Wauwatosa group, and we used to give him quite a hard time. But one Sunday, he did bring a nativity scene into our classroom to give us a visual representation of the birth of Jesus. And he was explaining that for kids especially, just like when we have our children's sermons, a visual representation is quite helpful because sometimes people just don't listen. But when you see it right here in front of you, it becomes more significant and real somehow. The picture does a better job of bringing Christmas into our households than just talking about Christmas. The words fall short, but then the aroma of the turkey or the beef or the, if you're vegan or vegetarian, whatever you're having, it makes all the difference in the world, you know. Earlier in the service, you heard Penny, and she shared one of the many beautiful stories of Christmas. Of course, there's also the manger scene story. But each of the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke especially, really, they're the ones that focus really on the birth of Jesus. And the ancient Hebrew prophets like Micah and Isaiah, they anticipate the birth of a future Messiah king. The poetry from Micah goes like this: "But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from old, from ancient of days. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people Israel. And he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall live secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be the one of peace." And that's from Micah chapter 5, verses 2 through the first part of 5, the verse 5. And the poetry from Isaiah reads, "He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young." So the words in poetry, they are beautiful, but consider the music of Handel's Messiah. All of us will be, those of us who can gather tonight and listen to the Messiah sing along right here in our church. It's an annual festive occasion. Those who are voices can sit and sing, and those who do not can be the audience. It's the sacredness of music. It just brings the season to life. Those who are here for our Christmas Eve service recognize the magnificence of music by our various talented church artists. And there are many mediums that convey the message. The Russian female dancer Pavlova was once asked by an admirer, "What were you trying to say in that last dance number?" And she replied, "You think I would have danced it if I could have said it?" And the whole point is, you dance. For Pavlova, her art of communication was through dancing, unspeakable but visual beyond the words. Handel wanted to share his faith and love for God through music. Visual artists like Michelangelo recognized the power of the paint and oils, watercolor, etchings on canvas, or carvings in stone, architectural masterpieces. They're all absolutely significant. Words can also move the soul and spirit, or at least this is the way it works for me, because that's what I have right here. These are the words. This is the sermon. It's what I do. Don't ask me to paint. Don't ask me to sing. I won't do it. You have to recognize your gifts, your talents, and your limitations. Somehow, sometimes, and all of you know it quite well, it is difficult to get a word in edgewise. John gets to be up here periodically so I can speak. In many of the Unitarian churches, however, there's quite an argument going. "I don't agree with you, John," as he's speaking something from the pulpit. By the way, as Congregationalists, you're free to do that anytime you want. But anyway, one of the things that I am constantly in the process of learning, and it's prayer. Because prayer, I believe, is more listening than talking. You notice that when I did the prayer, I I moved right into the prayer. I didn't give enough time for silence. And yet silence is so significant in that prayer time. You may, some of you, agree that the silent prayer part is the most significant part of the whole prayer time. The difficulty is that any single individual cannot be an Isaiah or a Handel or a Michelangelo or a Pavlova with otherworldly gifts who move beyond this earthly realm to that of the sacred and bring the divine into life through the word, through music, through painting and dance. We all yearn to understand the nature of the divine. We may also yearn for some future Shangri-La or Holy Ark or Holy Grail, Fountain of Youth, or the lost city of Atlantis. Why are we seeking God so far and wide outside of ourselves? There is an ancient Hasidic story about God discussing with the angels where to hide the secret of life so that it would be most difficult for humans to find. One angel suggested that God hide this secret in the bowels of the earth, while another the bottom of the seas, and a third remarked that the secret ought to be hidden on the highest mountaintop in the world. A fourth angel objected, however, and said, "People will eventually search and discover all of those places. The only place possible to put this secret of life is to hide it inside each human being, because a person will never dream of looking there." When we look at that child in the nativity scene, we can be reminded that God has implanted a spark of the divine nature within every human being. We could remember that the life and teachings of Jesus were his gifts to us and to God. Jesus didn't write any poems or paint any pictures or create any music or dance any dances that we know of. At least nothing seems evident in the Second Testament. Yet his very life of service is a testimony and gift conveying God's unspeakable gift of love, and it becomes ours as we live out that ancient story. The story is not centered on Jesus way out there, but where Jesus pointed inward to the human heart, as well as out there to what we can do with our lives. Therefore, rather than to seek Jesus, we ought to seek what Jesus sought. And it begins within us. Ruth Peale, the wife of Norman Vincent Peale, told a story once about an African boy who presented his missionary teacher with a magnificent and beautiful seashell Christmas gift. The boy had walked many miles to find it at a bay. Special Bay is the name of it, the only place where these particular seashells could be found. "How wonderful of you to have traveled so far to bring me this beautiful present," said the teacher, who was very impressed and grateful. The boy's eyes sparkled when he replied, "Long walk, part of gift." Like the wise men who traveled from great distances, like our own journey of faith, we should remember that it is not just in our artistic gifts that we share with God, but also it is in making God's words become flesh in us through our service to others, doing justice, acting with kindness, and walking with humility in this beautiful kingdom on earth. That will make all the difference. Amen.